is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. The images of Muammar Gaddafi taken in Sirte yesterday are graphic and grisly. There were conflicting reports about how the Libyan dictator died, but there's no confusion that his brutal regime has come to an end, brought down by anti-government forces inspired by the Arab Spring. NATO and the U.S. provided air support while several Arab countries provided reinforcements. We begin our conversation today on Radio Times about Libya with Abderrahim Foukara, and he's Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera International. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you again, Marty.
I've been looking at those videos, as I'm sure you have and many other people have, whether it's cell phone or even video on Al Jazeera. Is there any confusion, you think, today about how Muammar Gaddafi died yesterday?
Well, there is still confusion about how he died, because the statements that we've heard from various Libyans in the leadership of the so-called Libyan Revolution have been conflicting. Some of the people who were actually involved in capturing al-Qaddafi yesterday said different things among themselves. And then the political leadership of the movement has been saying he was already wounded when he was captured, and then he was killed in when later on fighting erupted between his captors and some of his supporters. The video, though, seems to suggest that when he was arrested, he was alive. He was able to walk, although with some difficulty. And if it does turn out that he was actually executed in cold blood, as some people have been suggesting, that obviously would not be sending a particularly positive message about the future of rule of law in Libya. But there's no doubt about it that he tormented Libyans for 42 years. The question is, are they going to be able to build a system in which the atrocities committed under his regime for 42 years will not be replicated down the road in Libya's future?
But does it raise questions about the leadership in Libya today and its ability to control those that work to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi?
Well, the ability of the Libyan leadership over the last 8 or 9 months since the start of the revolution in Libya, there have been questions about the ability of that leadership to do various things, to work in concert in an organized manner. But I guess a lot of people would be willing to cut that leadership slack because it operated under very difficult conditions right from the start. Remember that under Gaddafi, no opposition was allowed in Libya. There was no political organization other than the organization that he led himself in politics and society. The fact that they have been able to, obviously with the help of NATO, to carry out this mission and get rid of al-Qaddafi, at least militarily for now, does suggest that at the end of the day, they are capable of undertaking big assignments. To what extent they will now be able to coalesce into a political force that will lead Libya in an organized and smooth way through the transition into a more democratic system, obviously that remains the big question.
And that's always a challenge for groups that overthrow a government or a dictator like Muammar Gaddafi, which you can coalesce around getting rid of him. But the question is, can you work together to create a new country?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. There's absolutely no doubt that inside Libya and even outside Libya throughout the Arab world, there's been a lot of anger at al-Qaddafi and others like him in the region, what they've done to their countries and to their peoples over the last few decades. So the anger is understandable. The concern is that to what extent will these revolutions be able to actually turn the natural instinct that people have in revolutions for revenge into drive to create rule of law, and rather than taking revenge on the head of a political regime and his supporters, creating legal mechanisms for dealing with them, because ultimately that's the only way that would take Libya to the shore of safety. Libya, even now, it faces huge challenges, not just in terms of rebuilding its infrastructure that has been virtually completely destroyed, but in terms of bringing the country together. The country, as we know, has traditionally been divided along geographic lines, along tribal lines, and now even within the leadership that has led this revolution, there are differences. There are Islamists. There are people who call themselves secularists. And so you're going to see a lot of jockeying for power. You're going to see different conflicting visions of how the future of Libya should be tackled and led. If they do come around a minimum of common denominators, then obviously that bodes well for the country. But what we're hearing now from the various corners of the leadership, we are actually hearing warnings about chaos unless they get their act together. Although some of them are saying, if we have been able to fight this revolution and bring it to this conclusion, we are perfectly also able of leading the country into democracy.
I'm trying to imagine what it must have been like, though, to live under Muammar Gaddafi, and he was in power for 42 years, which is, you know, at least two generations for Libyan people.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's obviously, you know, it's the old adage, the harder they come, the harder they fall. Gaddafi took over in 1969, after a coup, which he later on termed as a military coup, which he later on termed as a revolution. And I guess the kind of language that he spoke in the initial stages of his rule did appeal to Libyans and to Arabs as a whole as something positive. He spoke this anti-colonial rhetoric. He spoke a third world rhetoric, which all at the time sounded good and well to people. But later on, people began to realize that the rhetoric was very different from what the policies that he actually pursued inside Libya. And he was totally ruthless and brutal to his opponents, both inside Libya. He just did not allow any political dissent, but also outside Libya. His opponents, his Libyan opponents outside of Libya in exile, for example, he called them stray dogs. And referring to them as stray dogs, that meant a green light to his security services to do whatever they saw fit to do with that opposition. And I think the question now is, will Libyans, after 42 years of brutal dictatorship, will they be able to actually steer the country away from that? They do have the momentum, not just at the level of Libya, but also at the level of what's going on throughout North Africa and the Middle East. Will they be able to put that to good use? There are signs to suggest that they are perfectly capable of doing that, but there are also concerns, as we saw yesterday, if it does turn out that al-Qaddafi was executed in cold blood.
And are we talking about an educated population? I know Libya has oil, so it has the potential for an economy that could support a country. Do you see some of the features that would allow Libya to recreate itself?
Well, you know, Libya, obviously, as you rightly pointed out, has a wealth of oil. And it has a very small population. The population of the indigenous population of Libya is just a little under 6 million people. One of the big surprises, even to Arabs, about Libyans over the last few months, as they've been exposed to them expressing their desire for change on Arab television, is the extent to which these people can be articulate. Their political understanding and analysis of what's going on in Libya and around it is really profound and has surprised a lot of people. So in terms of brain power, I don't think there's any shortage of brain power in Libya to help it do the right thing for its future. But, you know, very, very bright people, that does not necessarily mean a very, very bright political system. The question remains as to what sort of political system they'll be able to build to help them fashion a better future for themselves.
Do you think that there are elements of Libyan society still loyal to Gaddafi or to his regime?
Well, I mean, predictably, there will always, in a case like that, people who will remain loyal and who will feel a sense of nostalgia, if you will, for the old ruler, even if he were a dictator. He was obviously, throughout his rule, very good to some segments of Libyan society, to some tribes. I mean, if you take a look, for example, at his hometown of Sirte, it's one of it was, before it got destroyed in the recent fighting, it was one of the best built cities in Libya. The infrastructure, to the extent we could make out, was excellent. And it's going to be very difficult for people who were treated by him with that kind of privilege to forsake their loyalty for him. That's why the new leadership, now that it has brought the whole country under its control, has to try very hard to accommodate everyone, not just the people who rebelled against him, but also the people who could potentially remain loyal to him, and bring everybody into the tent of trying to fashion a better future for everyone in Libya.
And we have about a minute before I have to say goodbye. And how much do you think Libya needs to be disarmed? How awash in weapons is it?
That is obviously, from all the reports that we get, that is a very serious issue. There are a lot of weapons in Libya. There were a lot of weapons in Libya even before the revolution started. But over the last few months, obviously, Libyans have armed themselves to the teeth. There is a school of thought that says that because there may be still remnants of the old regime, the rebels should not disarm yet until they've taken care of that. But obviously, the country being awash in weapons will be a major concern down the road for everybody in Libya, but also for Libya's neighbors.
Well, much more to talk about, and I appreciate the fact that you could join us today on Radio Times. Abderrahim Fukar, thank you so much.
Good to be with you, Marty, and your listeners.
Thank you very much. And he's the Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera International, and we are talking about Libya, the issue, the story that everyone is talking about today. Yesterday, Muammar Gaddafi was killed. There are questions about how he was killed. It is our topic for today's Radio Times. Much more. We have a second guest waiting in the wings, and we'll be right back.
How does where you are influence what you do? The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY and presents Here, an exhibition that looks at how the work of contemporary artists is saturated with the experience of where they live. On view October 22nd through December 31st, Here showcases the work of 24 artists and artist collectives from six different regions of the country. For details, 215-972-7600 or PAFA.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. When the news broke yesterday about the death of Muammar Gaddafi, we knew what we had to do today. The Radio Times producers were calling potential guests all afternoon and into the night. That's our job. That's also why you listen to WHYY and to programs like Radio Times. You decide what that's worth and then make a pledge of support. Here's that phone number, 1-888-345-9499. And you can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks for calling.
The Philadelphia Film Festival supports WHYY. From now through November 3rd, the Philadelphia Film Festival takes place in the city for its landmark 20th anniversary. Featuring over 120 films and more than 200 screenings, the Philadelphia Film Festival delivers festival selections from Toronto, Sundance, Cannes, and more. Ticket information and a full schedule of screenings are available online at filmadelphia.org or by phone at 267-239-2941.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made a surprise visit to Libya earlier this week to meet with the country's leaders. 48 hours later, Libya's brutal and eccentric dictator Muammar Gaddafi was killed in his hometown of Sirte. This ends 8 months of fighting, although Secretary Clinton cautioned on Tuesday, now the hard part begins. The U.S. had joined NATO in support of the anti-government fighters, and President Obama was both praise and criticize for making that decision. Michelle Dunn joins us now. She's director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a Washington, D.C. based think tank. And Michelle Dunn, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Your reaction to the death of Muammar Gaddafi? Michelle?
Well, look, this is, you know, I think the bigger step really was when the Libyan rebel forces entered Tripoli. Since then, the change has really started making. It has really started happening. What we see now is with the death of Gaddafi is that sort of the cleanup operations are now more or less over. And this it's really interesting that the death of Gaddafi is seen clearly as setting into motion a political timetable. The transitional leadership issued a draft constitutional declaration some months ago in which they laid out a political timetable, and that has stuck. And now it's because of the death of Gaddafi that they will be obligated to move forward with that.
And I'm quoting here from McClatchy about the transitional council, the National Transitional Council, and they part of what they I guess need to do and intend to do: bring the militias under control, recover looted arms, halting revenge attacks, taking care of the casualties, restoring oil production, repairing war damage, and keeping a lid on regional tensions and radical Islam. That's a long and difficult list of a to-do list.
Yeah, the security issues, of course, have to come first because nothing else will be able to happen. You won't be able to get the oil production and economy back on its feet, and you won't be able to move forward with a political transition if you don't get security under control. So that's going to be the top priority. But actually, the transitional leadership has been working on those issues and has done probably better than a lot of people would have predicted in reestablishing basic security and getting local governance going in the time that they've been in control of most of the country. But now they're supposed to move forward. They're supposed to actually officially declare the liberation of the country, I believe, as of tomorrow. And then that starts a clock ticking. They're going to form a transitional government within 30 days, and then they say in their documents that they will then hold elections, the first free elections that Libya has had. They had some elections back in the 60s, but they were not particularly free. Hold elections within 8 months, within 240 days, for a kind of national conference. This is in a way kind of a constituent assembly body that would appoint a new government, that would oversee the drafting of a new constitution, and then all of that will eventually lead to more elections for an actual parliament.
But what's interesting is Tunisia, where the Arab Spring essentially got started, they're having elections this Sunday, and they're, of course, right next door to Libya.
Yes, that's right. They're electing a constituent assembly, and that assembly is supposed to appoint a new government and oversee the drafting of a new constitution, and that is supposed to take place basically within 1 year. And then they'll move to more elections after that.
Do you see, I mean, as complicated as the Arab Spring has been, and there are points at which, certainly in Libya, the fighting went on for months, and we can see from the images just devastation in certain parts of that country. But do you see the Arab Spring really taking hold in the Middle East and, of course, in North Africa here, and bringing about the kind of reforms that the movers and shakers behind the Arab Spring had hoped for?
Look, it's a long process. These countries, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and it's interesting, you now have sort of a geographic block in North Africa of the Arab Spring, three contiguous countries that have undergone change. They're started down a road of change. They're not going to emerge as fully fledged democracies in a year or two. It's going to take much longer than that. But I do think these countries are ultimately, in the longer run, when it's, 10 years from now we look back, I think we're going to say that they're much better off than they would have been had they remained under the authoritarian leaderships that they had before these revolutions.
Does it also raise questions and perhaps even say that what NATO did, what the United States did, of course, with the support of the Arab League and the United Nations, that there's a kind of a template for how the international community can respond to these kinds of crises?
I wouldn't call it a template. The circumstances in Libya were unique, especially the fact that Gaddafi had made enemies of so many other Arab leaders, notably Saudi Arabia, King of Saudi Arabia, and so forth, that there was an Arab consensus. Most of the Arab countries, not all of them, Algeria and Syria always still objected, but most of the other Arab countries approved of international military intervention and the imposition of a no-fly zone over Libya. That was a really unusual circumstance. And we're certainly not there with how the rest of the Arab world believes the international community should treat Syria, for example, or Yemen.
But at the same time, do you think, and the president did, he got some praise, but he also got some criticism for the U.S. role in NATO. Obviously, there's no appetite in this country to engage in another war in a direct kind of way, as we did in Iraq and Afghanistan. But do you think one gets a sense of how the Obama administration sees the use of U.S. power in the world?
Yes. There was quite a fight inside the Obama administration about whether to become involved at all in the international intervention in Libya. It would not have been possible. I'm convinced there certainly would not have been a UN Security Council resolution and NATO putting together this effort had the United States not really led it. Although the United States was quiet about it, it was when President Obama made up his mind and decided that we would support and become involved in international military intervention, that it became possible. So even though the United States doesn't need to be doing things out on its own, American leadership really still is essential within international institutions and international military efforts if anything's going to happen.
Do you think then the Obama administration did the right thing?
I think they did the right thing. It sort of got down to the 11th hour. I was very frightened at the time that there was going to be a massacre in Benghazi. That was just was on the eve of that happening, and I think we see now that had President Obama not made the decision that he did, we would not be seeing the outcome that we're seeing today. I think what would have happened is Gaddafi would have put down the uprising brutally, and we would have seen months and probably years of ongoing violence among Libyans as they struggled against Gaddafi.
And that's Michelle Dunn, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, as we talk about Libya. The 42-year reign of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, of course, was killed yesterday. There are questions about the circumstances of his death, but nonetheless, he is dead. There is going to be an investigation into whether he was executed on the ground or exactly how he died, but nonetheless, it raises a whole host of questions about the future of this country, the role of the United States, and the international community. And Michelle Dunn is director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a Washington, D.C.-based think tank, and we have called her up several times this year as we have been following the Arab Spring. She also co-chairs the Working Group on Egypt, and this is a bipartisan group of people established in February 2010 to mobilize U.S. government attention to the forces of change in that country. Going back to Libya, Michelle, I mean, when you see, certainly in some of the cities, in some parts of that country, I mean, the devastation from the fighting, from the air campaign is really just breathtaking. Does that concern you?
It's concerning. There's going to be a tremendous effort to, need to be a tremendous effort to rebuild Libya. There was a great deal of devastation during the fighting. But what was the case even before that? Libya was very poorly developed. You know, this is one of the crimes Gaddafi committed against his people, is after all those decades of large oil revenues, and it wasn't invested in the country. Libya, the Libyan infrastructure, the educational system, the health system, and so forth, were really at a pretty low level. Libyans were not living in abject poverty, but they certainly weren't living at the standard that they should have been living at, considering how wealthy the country was. So there are decades of neglect in infrastructure and in human development that need to be made up for now.
Is there money also in the bank? I mean, there were sanctions against Libya, and I was reading in some of the papers this morning that, I mean, there's money in the bank somewhere.
Well, the good thing is there are Libya's sovereign wealth funds that are invested abroad, and I think those will be able to be returned to the Libyan, I believe, to the transitional government. I mean, there are legal steps involved in doing that, but I believe the new Libyan government will be able to claim those funds. Some of them have already been returned, the sort of easily available liquid assets. And then beyond that, there will be, you know, a process of discovery of the hidden wealth of Gaddafi and his family and so forth. And one can only speculate on how much that might be and where it is. All of these things, though, these are going to be a help. But what's really important is that the country starts producing oil again and developing its economy. And one issue that I don't hear people talking about a lot that I think is important is that the new government of Libya develops a transparent and non-corrupt system of collecting and distributing and using the oil revenues because having a large amount of mineral wealth can really be, it's a blessing and a curse. It's very difficult for a country to become a democracy with that kind of wealth because the opportunities for corruption are just so enormous.
Do you think the U.S. should play an active role or a more behind-the-scenes role as Libya reforms itself?
Because the United States and several of the major European powers, France and Britain particularly, were out in front in helping the Libyan rebels achieve victory, there is going to be a good amount of receptivity in Libya, I think, to help from the United States and from the European countries. But it really needs to be at the Libyans' request. I mean, this is certainly not a situation in which the United States can be imposing itself. I think, though, there will be a need for a lot of technical assistance, management assistance, and eventually, I mean, Libya is going to be able to pay for most of this. This is not going to be a situation where outsiders need to be giving large donations to Libya. There may be short-term needs, but Libya is going to be able to pay for the help that it needs.
And what do you think the impact is going to be, or perhaps already is, on Egypt, of course, one of Libya's neighbors?
Egypt is going through a troubling phase of its transition. You know, the Egyptian protesters carried out kind of a halfway revolution. They brought down Hosni Mubarak, but they then turned over the keys to the Egyptian military, which is still in place. Now, the Egyptian military has promised to move forward with elections and so forth, and in fact, they've set a date for parliamentary elections to begin in late November of this year. But there are a lot of signs that the military is looking to carve out a large political role for itself, a role that really may not be compatible with the development of a real democracy in Egypt. So it's a bit of a troubling situation. There have been very troubling sectarian incidents and riots in which many people have been killed, and the military's not doing a good job at handling those kind of situations. So I don't know that the Libyan situation is going to have a lot of effect on Egypt. Egyptians are very preoccupied with dealing with their own internal problems right now.
And some of that sectarian violence was in the last couple of weeks involving Coptic Christians.
Yes. I happened to be in Cairo.
Really?
At the time, and there was a demonstration, started out as a peaceful demonstration in Cairo against the burning of a church in southern Egypt, and it was a very strange incident. Thugs started coming out and attacking the demonstrators. Egyptian state television claimed that the Christian demonstrators were attacking the army and called on people to come out in the streets and defend the army, and it descended into a terribly violent incident in which more than 20 people were killed.
What a cautionary tale, or something certainly to be concerned about.
There are underlying issues of discrimination and sectarian feeling in Egyptian society that the Egyptian ruling military council is unwilling to take on. Mubarak was unwilling to take on. Every time there's one of these sectarian incidents, and this is the third major one in Egypt since the revolution, and there were others before the revolution as well, the Egyptian government sort of promises, yes, we're going to investigate, yes, we'll prosecute crimes that were committed during this incident, yes, we'll redo the discriminatory laws and so forth that lead to these kind of incidents, and yet we really don't see those steps taken over the long term. Often what happens is, as soon as public attention moves on, the Egyptian government quietly drops all of that, and so then the problem just snowballs over time.
Let me quote something, and this is actually, I read in the New York Times about the Arab Twitter sphere lighting up with gleeful comments. This was after Muammar Gaddafi was killed, and I'm just quoting here. One of the tweets said, Ben Ali escaped, Mubarak is in jail, Gaddafi was killed. Which fate do you prefer, Ali Abdullah Saleh? Will you consult with Bashar? And then another tweet says, Bashar al-Assad, how do you feel today? Obviously, focusing on Yemen and Syria. Do you think those countries' leaders are nervous now?
Well, yes, of course they're nervous. And in Syria, we've already seen a reaction. There have been today large demonstrations in a couple of Syrian cities and more than a dozen people killed in demonstrations in Homs and Homa. These were specifically pro-Libya, you know, demonstrations asking the very same questions that you are citing here. And Yemen is also in an increasingly violent situation. These two countries are stuck in sort of protracted uprisings that are not yet producing any clear political outcome. It seems to me that of these three leaders, President Ben Ali of Tunisia was the wise one. You know, he left and went into exile. He certainly had the most comfortable fate. Hosni Mubarak is on trial, and we see the very brutal fate that Gaddafi met with.
So things are still quite unsettled. But as always, Michelle Dunn, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty.
And she's the director of the Rafiq Harari Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. She also co-chairs the Working Group on Egypt, and that's a group that was established in February 2010 to mobilize U.S. government attention to the forces of change in that country. And we began our conversation with Abdirahim Fukara of Al Jazeera International. We have waiting in the wings a Libyan-born poet. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, it's Hungarian and Roma music from East Gypsy Band. Featuring saxophonist Tim Reese, East Gypsy Band fuses the traditions of Roma music with the improvisational characteristics of jazz. Beginning at 5:45, more details are available at philamuseum.org. The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowane. When the news broke yesterday about the death of Muammar Gaddafi, we knew what we had to do today. The Radio Times producers were calling potential guests all afternoon and into the night. That's our job. That's also why you listen to WHYY and to programs like Radio Times. You decide what that's worth and then make a pledge of support. Here's that phone number, 1-888-345-9499, and you can also pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks for calling.
Widener Law supports WHYY. For those thinking about law school and not sure what to expect, Widener Law is holding an information session October 29th at their Delaware campus from 9:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. Prospective students can attend a mock first-year class, meet current law students, and speak to faculty members. Again, this special information session is being held at Widener Law's Delaware campus October 29th from 9:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. More information at law.widener.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Khaled Matawa was born in Benghazi, Libya, and came to the United States in 1979 when he was a teenager. He's a poet and associate professor of English and creative writing at the University of Michigan. He won the 2010 Fellowship Prize from the Academy of American Poets. He became an outspoken critic of Muammar Gaddafi, and he joins us on Radio Times to talk about his life in Libya and what he's thinking about today. And we have also asked him to read one of his poems. And Khaled Matawa, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have him?
One of your programs, and I used to listen to your station when I lived in New Jersey for
a year. Oh, you
did?
Oh, that's great. Well, it's so nice to have you on the phone, and I was trying to think of a clever question to ask you to get us started, but I couldn't get beyond. What are your thoughts today?
My thoughts today are at home with my relatives and my loved ones and my friends, the poets and the writers. I mean, this day was coming. I think my sense of the end of the Gaddafi regime was when Tripoli was liberated. Mm-hmm. So this is perhaps more of a denouement than the high drama of the collapse of the regime.
I assume
what I've had constantly during the revolution is like, I need to pack up and go home. I need to pack up and go home. And I've had that sort of moment all through yesterday, and I'm having it again today. My sense is I would like to go to my native land and be there again. I was there this summer, but I've had this desire to go and see what's happening, and also to see about a kind of future there, a better, a stronger connection with the country.
And I assume you still have family in Libya.
Yes, I have family in Benghazi and in Tripoli as well.
And how are they doing?
They're fine. I mean, I was trying to locate some family, and it turned out that many of them, at least in Benghazi, were out in the square where it all started. And we talked to some other friends and relatives in Tripoli, and they're all out and about celebrating the end of this nightmare.
I know you came to the States in 1979, and you were, what, a 16, 17-year-old?
15, if I may not age myself too much.
A 15-year-old. And I read somewhere that the thought was, and you were here with one of your brothers, I guess,
mm-hmm.
was it to, in a sense, wait out Gaddafi. That was more than 30 years ago.
Exactly, yes. That was it. We were trying to finish our education. The schools were going downhill very quickly during the Gaddafi era. Things were being handed over into the military, or schools were being militarized. It just seemed like a good time to leave the country. And, of course, persecution was increasing of people as young as myself at the time. And so we thought, okay, we will go and finish our education. I finished high school in the U.S. and then college. And by the time it was the late 80s, I was in my mid-20s, and even when there was a kind of amnesty, it didn't seem like safe enough for me to return, though my brother did go back home. But yeah, it was years of studying and waiting, and the combination was not very... was not very good, because you really didn't know what you wanted to study or what you were hoping to happen when you came home. Lives were being built in Libya with a great deal of uncertainty. Mm. And so for me, deciding to stay gave me a bit of that certainty in an interesting way.
And I read some of your descriptions of being a young boy growing up, or young child, I should say, growing up in Libya, and seeing, and I hate to raise this, but I think people need to understand the kind of regime that you and your family lived under in Libya, seeing dissidents hung in the streets for people to observe.
That was absolutely true. This happened in Benghazi in 77, and thereafter in Tripoli as well. That and then the hangings being broadcast on television repeatedly to scare people. Gaddafi had this sort of veneer of showmanship. He had when I first came to the United States, some women would say he was a handsome man, which is an assessment that I absolutely hated. So he had a way of sort of covering up this absolute non-negotiable brutality with which he handled Libya. And of course, the other side was that there were people in Africa and Asia and elsewhere who thought that he was a revolutionary assisting revolution all over the world. We knew it wasn't correct, because nobody who was for revolution and freedom would in the world would brutalize his own people in this manner. So it was just he really had a strange kind of reputation and PR that for a long time we couldn't break through, because there were just so many factors that people couldn't get around in order to realize that he's just a brutal, vicious dictator.
I would love to have you read a poem of yours. It's called Now That We Have Tasted Hope.
Yes, it's a poem I wrote at the beginning of the event, and there are moments when the poet believes in his premonition and is not disappointed. And when I wrote this poem at the beginning of the revolution, I thought we will win, and I'm glad we did, though, it did cost many lives, I'm not...
We seem to have lost our guest. Let's see if we can...
We're back on.
Yeah. Okay, we're back on. Okay, I was afraid we had lost you. You're saying you wrote this at the beginning of this year when the fighting broke out, and perhaps you could read this for us.
Sure. Now that we have tasted hope, now that we have come out of hiding, why would we live again in the tombs we'd made out of our souls? And the sundered bodies that we've reassembled with prayers and consolations, what would their torn parts be other than flesh? Now that we have tasted hope and dressed each other's wounds with the legends of our oneness, why would we prefer anything other than to close our mouths forever, shut on the wines that swilled inside them, having dreamed the same dream, having found the water that gushed behind a thousand mirages? Why would we hide from the sun again, or fear the night sky after we've reached the ends of darkness, live in death again after all the life our dead have given us? Listen to me, Zawiya, Beda, Ashdabia, Tobruk, Trablus, Nalut, Derna, Masrata, Benghazi, Zinten. Listen to me, houses, alleys, courtyards, and streets that throng my veins. Someday soon, in your freed night, and in the shade of your proud trees, your disinterred heroes will return to their thrones in your martyr square. lovers will hold each other's hands. I need not look far to imagine the nerves dying, rejecting the life that blood sends them. I need not look deep into my past to seek a thousand hopeless vistas. But now that I have tasted hope, I have fallen into the embrace of my own rugged innocence. How long were my ancient days? I no longer care to count. How long were the mountains and my ocean's fathoms? I no longer care to measure. How bitter was the bread of bitterness? I no longer recall. Now that we have tasted hope, now that we have lived on this hard-earned crust, we would sooner die than seek any other taste to life, any other way of being human.
And that's our guest, Khaled Matawa, reading a poem that he wrote earlier this year, Now That We Have Tasted Hope. He was born in Libya, came to the United States as a teenager in 1979. He is a poet, in fact, won the 2010 Fellowship Prize from the Academy of American Poets, and he's an associate professor of English and creative writing at the University of Michigan. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Thank you so much for reading that poem, and one can sense the hope, obviously, in and also just the kind of suffering that so many Libyans have experienced.
And it's been so varied, and it has covered all sorts of places and regions of the country. The desire for this dictator to be not simply obeyed but adored, to not be critiqued, to not receive any advice, to not relent. I mean, he introduced the Green Book in 1975. You know, the whole theory fell apart by 1982. Yet, until the last minute that he had control of the radio stations, he was broadcasting segments of this Green Book, which he already and his son and everyone around him had acknowledged was a complete failure. They never apologized for anything. They would never let the families know where their dead were. They just completely were ruthless and relentless in demanding complete obedience and utter obliviousness from everyone around them. And you know, it couldn't go on for long. You know, with people in Libya, I think most of them tried to create an alternative life. They tried to maintain friendship, even though trust was not easy to maintain. Libya was one of the poorest regions of the world. And in America, we talk about people growing up in the Depression and developing a mindset of frugality and so on. Libyans for centuries had lived in this complete impoverishment, and so their mindset was to hoard, to gather up as much money or foodstuff for their family, and they left the politics to the politicians. They let Caesar be Caesar. And when Gaddafi came to power, they also went along with that mindset. But he impoverished them, for the law. He froze salaries for 32 years. I mean, from 1979, salaries of government employees never were adjusted. People were impoverished. I left Libya in 79, came back in 2000, and people were driving the same cars they had in the 70s. Their teeth had fallen, their clothes were worn, they had metal wire holding up their sandals. You know, these are respectable middle-class people, and they just lived in this utter needless poverty in a very rich country. So he humiliated the Libyan people, not only made life hard for them, he just sort of subjected them to humiliation on and on and on again. And there is a new generation that just refuses, and they didn't think that they should live under this situation.
And that's Khaled Matawa, our third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We are talking about Libya, and again, he was born in Libya. He's now a poet and associate professor of English and creative writing at the University of Michigan. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Ed Cunningham here with Debbie Builder, one of the producers of Radio Times. And Debbie, I know that at a moment like this, you're proud of what you and your staff and Marty have accomplished on a momentous day that we are having. It's momentous in many ways, most of all, of course, for the Libyan people. But for the coverage of it, it's something that we're proud to ask for your support of right now.
Yeah, you know, you can imagine that yesterday when this happened, everyone was scrambling to get guests on the subject, thoughtful people, experts. And one of the great things about working for Radio Times is the 25 years that Marty's been doing this, or almost 25 years, she has earned so much respect from people that even at a time when all these experts' phones are ringing off the hook, if you get to them, they know the show, they respect it, they respect what Marty does. And so we're able to bring you these conversations with people of the different perspectives of a, you know, a Libyan poet, of an expert on the country itself and the politics, and then a reporter talking about what's going on also. Give us a call right now. Support this so that we can make sure we can do this for another 25 years. 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-9499. Become a member of WHYY.
This is going to be one of the final opportunities during this membership campaign, which is getting closer and closer every moment to coming to its conclusion, probably one of your final opportunities to make a pledge particularly around this program. And I don't mean to say that you're making a pledge just for Radio Times, but it can't be denied that when you're listening to a particular program and you give us a membership pledge at a particular hour, it will be noted, in this case, that it was around Radio Times and that it means as much to you and that you respect it as much as do all the experts that Debbie just mentioned. So please do let us know what this program means to you in the form of a pledge. It's 1-888-345-9499. And as if on cue, and in some ways that's true, WHYY.org, that's where you can pledge online. And you know it is, these are not random pings, Debbie, that happen. Uh-huh. We realize the way it works. You fill out the forms, you know, your name, address, what gift you'd like, and so forth. And then you hit the send button. And when you do it, when we are on the air, when our mics are open, you hear the ping on the air. People are savvy to that. They want to hear their own personal ping happen. So if you've got a few more minutes to do it, if you'd like to pledge online at WHYY.org, your ping will be heard and we'll be darn happy for it.
And we have these amazing volunteers from the Mural Arts Program and amazing food that they are eating from Fork, that Fork provided, but they will not mind putting that delicious food down for a minute to answer your call. Right now, 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY.
And it's, by the way, October is Mural Month, and you should get out there and check some of the murals because they are nationally and internationally famous. The murals that some people have done on the walls of some of our buildings, really absolutely something to see. I have a quote here, by the way, Debbie, from Amy in Pottstown, made a pledge, and then made a comment. She says, "It's hard to pick just one program, but I really enjoy the in-depth analysis of topics that Marty explores during Radio Times. Thank you for the terrific programming, and thank you for that pledge, Amy, and for those nice thoughts. I know that they are